Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Marianne Wagner, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Puget Sound Keeper was the first grassroots organization to focus exclusively on protecting the marine environment of Puget Sound when it was first founded in 1984 as the Puget Sound Alliance. Other organizations have since joined the effort to protect and conserve the water quality of Puget Sound and the Salish Sea region, but Puget Sound Keeper continues to be a leader in this area. To find out why, today we'll be talking with Blair Engelbrecht and Gillian Flippo with Puget Sound Keeper. Gillian is the stewardship coordinator with Puget Sound Keeper. She organizes and coordinates community engagement events such as beach cleanups, kayak patrols, and community science programs. She also partners with other groups on local projects focusing on pollution prevention in Puget Sound. Blair Engelbrecht is the voting programs manager and policy analyst for Puget Sound Keeper Alliance. She works on recreational and commercial vessel and marine debris policy in Washington State. In addition to policy work, she runs Clean Marina Washington, a free voluntary pollution prevention program for Washington State marinas. And she skippers Soundkeeper's patrol vessel, which we will learn more about. And I really need to learn more about what that is. So welcome, Blair and Gillian.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah. Tell us briefly about Puget Soundkeeper and the role it plays in our area.
Yeah. Puget Soundkeeper is a nonprofit in Seattle. Our mission is to protect and enhance the waters of Puget Sound for the health and the restoration of the aquatic ecosystems and the communities that depend on it. We do this through three main strategies: policy, litigation, so taking legal action when necessary, and community engagement.
So Puget Soundkeeper was modeled after an organization originally called Hudson Riverkeeper in New York, a program that I understand was begun by a group of fishermen concerned about the health of the water. So are you part of a national effort like that with similar programs across the country?
Yes, there are actually over 300 waterkeeper organizations and affiliates on six different continents fighting for communities' clean water rights. And waterkeepers can be large or small like ours, but every waterkeeper patrols their waterways and enforces clean water protections when agencies and the federal government are failing to do so. Puget Soundkeeper Alliance was founded in 1984 and in 1990 became just the sixth waterkeeper organization in the world. And we were actually one of the founding members to launch the Global Waterkeeper Alliance. And now here in Washington, we're actually joined by several other groups. We have Columbia Riverkeeper, Twin Harbors Waterkeeper, Spokane Riverkeeper, and affiliates in North Sound Baykeeper and Deschutes Estuary Restoration Team. So there's keepers on all different kinds of water bodies all around the world and certainly all over the United States.
Well, that sounds like a real network of grassroots organizations. Tell us about the International Waterkeeper Alliance. Is that part of this group? How are you all connected through this organization?
Like I was just saying, there's over 300 waterkeeper groups around the world. So collectively, we're protecting over 2.5 million square miles of rivers, lakes, and coastal waterways on six different continents. Our Healthy Watersheds program manager, Anna Bachman, actually came to us from the Iraq Waterkeeper, which is pretty cool. So we at Puget Soundkeeper work on a lot of cross-boundary issues. You know, salmon and orca don't really recognize the border between British Columbia and Washington. So we do work on some international stuff, but there's also a waterkeeper up in British Columbia. They're all over Canada as well. So there's just a collaborative effort everywhere focusing on the same issues, but in like a very focused and local way.
So yeah, that's a fantastic network you've got there. And it's not only policy work, it's also enforcement, working with boaters to help keep the water quality clean. You have a Soundkeeper enforcement team. What exactly is that?
Yeah, the function of our enforcement team is threefold. There is working to improve regulations, permits, and policies so that they effectively stop pollution. Additionally, there's tracking compliance with regulations so that problems are revealed. And there's also suing polluters to stop pollution when all else fails.
Well, Soundkeeper actively patrols the waters of Puget Sound and monitors for pollution then. So how do you do that?
There are a couple of different ways that we patrol for pollution. My favorite way as the skipper of our patrol vessel is by heading out onto the sound and into places where we suspect there's a high likelihood of pollution on a boat, which is a requirement of being a waterkeeper. So every waterkeeper everywhere has a patrol vessel. In some places like North Sound Baykeeper or Twin Harbors, I believe, it's just a kayak, but we have a pretty nice patrol vessel. And so sometimes we receive reports from folks who call in from our pollution reporting hotline who might have spotted something like an oil sheen in a local waterway or pieces of styrofoam docking that have washed up on our local beaches. And other times our legal team will ask that we go out and observe a waterway where they suspect some industrial pollution is taking place. Being out on the water really gives a unique vantage point that we wouldn't get on land. So we can spot things like discolored stormwater coming out of an outfall or sediment coming off of bulkheads and into the waterway. And we're just able to pinpoint those sources and where they're coming from a lot easier than we were if we had to, say, like request a site visit from a cement company to go on site and actually look for those things. So that's my favorite way. Soundkeeper also has a unique program within Waterkeeper called Lost Urban Creeks. So Soundkeeper has a special focus on urban creeks and streams, partly because these are really critical salmon habitats. And when I say lost, I'm talking about streams and creeks that have been developed over due to roads, housing, and all the infrastructure that keeps our daily lives moving. But these neglected waterways are part of our Puget Sound watershed too. And through our Lost Urban Creeks project, we aim to improve water quality in South Seattle and King County watersheds through youth-led, community-based education, outreach, and stewardship. And these comprehensive programs teach our paid interns how to engage in water quality monitoring, restoration, and a bunch of other fun stuff.
Do you also encourage homeowners and folks that live near these creeks to monitor it themselves? I mean, do they work with you, community members?
We certainly have ways that homeowners can engage to figure out how healthy their own watersheds are. There are some community science projects that people can engage in, like our salmon monitoring surveys, so they can go into their own backyards in some cases if they live in the right area and see if they have good salmon habitat. And we also are always open to folks asking us if they can do a cleanup in their own neck of the woods. So we certainly encourage folks to steward their own neighborhoods and their own lands.
Wow. Well, Puget Sound Keeper helps set policies as well and regulations that protect our waterways. You had an early success with that when Puget Sound Keeper helped establish the secondary wastewater treatment facility at West Point in Seattle. That was a big win. Any recent successes?
Yes, we have had some recent successes. During the 2022 legislative session, we passed a bill, SB 5585, which lifts NPDES, which is also known as National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, also known as a Clean Water Act permit. That lifts the fee cap for municipal sewage treatment plant permits. And so Ecology experiences a $2 million shortfall to enforce this permit annually. So removing this cap will help them to catch up on a backlog of over 200 expired permits that need review. The funding will also help them to meet new Puget Sound Nutrient General Permit requirements. We also secured a stable funding source for the Department of Natural Resource Derelict Vessel Removal Program, which will help them to remove the inventory of abandoned or derelict vessels in the sound that can leak oil, fuel, and other toxic chemicals into the sound. Additionally, we passed bills to ensure that vessels carrying oil are able to cover the cost of a worst-case scenario spill and that tribes are included in oil spill contingency planning. We also helped to kill a bad bill, which would have created a lot of confusion over stock watering rights, potentially allowing for livestock to be watered in sensitive watersheds.
Wow, that's quite a list. You guys are very busy. And you mentioned that you have a legal team as well that's working on all this. Is that right?
Yes, we do.
So you also enforced the Clean Water Act of 1972, I understand, through legal action. In brief, what is the Clean Water Act of 72?
Yeah, so we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act this year. The Clean Water Act is a landmark federal statute that limits pollution flowing into waterways across the United States. And its broad goals are to protect waterways in order to keep them safe for fishing, swimming, and drinking. It's been working mainly as designed for 5 decades, but notably and very unfortunately, we've never met the original goal of the act, which is to eliminate all pollution into waterways by 1985. So the Clean Water Act governs everything from the temperatures of our streams, which is really vital for healthy salmon habitat. It regulates the permits that industrial and commercial sites are required to have before they can discharge. It informs the ways that states enforce clean water policies and how groups like ours and any individual with legal standing can also enforce the law. It informs how the EPA and states can manage estuaries and inland seas like Puget Sound. And it creates stormwater requirements that cities must follow and a whole bunch of other stuff that we don't have time to get into. But Puget Sound really doesn't have another 50 years for the Clean Water Act to fully protect our waterways and reach that ultimate goal. So there are a few reasons that we need to act right now to improve how we manage our watersheds. Firstly, our watersheds are becoming more and more densely populated. So many of our outdated sewage systems are fully burdened or overburdened. Pollutants are becoming smaller and more widespread, from chemicals and tires that kill coho to microplastics to PFAS, which is that really insidious chemical that is in basically everything that we own, and nutrients. So the problems that we face are becoming harder and a lot more expensive to solve. And then in places like Puget Sound, even despite hosts of clean water successes, most of the water quality indicators that we have are showing that our waterways are generally getting worse. And at best, they're unchanged from the 1990s. So this tells us that the Clean Water Act is, in some places, just about keeping up with the pressures of our societal decisions, but in most places, it's just not working well enough. So that's why we need Puget Sound Keeper and groups like ours. And to answer your question on lobbying, we do have a contract lobbyist. His name is Bruce Wishart, and he's really our eyes, ears, and voice most of the time on Capitol Hill. He's been with Puget Sound Keeper for a long time and does really excellent work. 501c3s actually have very specific rules about what we can and cannot do in terms of lobbying. So we're frequently up against really big moneyed entities like pulp and paper or oil companies. And all that we are armed with is the scientific truth about what's happening in our waterways and good policy solutions to fix it. So it's really vital that we have a consistent and well-respected presence on the Hill with our legislators. And we also have a lobby day every year where volunteers can train on lobbying, learn about our legislative priorities, and then ultimately join us in meetings with their legislators. And we recently started offering youth-specific advocacy workshops for high school students.
Oh, a little education for the next generation. That's really great. So another way you enforce the Clean Water Act is through legally, not just lobbying, but legally suing polluters to bring them into compliance, because you mentioned that earlier, that you sometimes last resort will sue polluters. And have you sued many? And what's that look like?
Yes, unfortunately, we have had to sue a ton of polluters. We are one of the most litigious waterkeeper groups, and that is not a responsibility that we take lightly. We have filed federal lawsuits against polluters 145 times. Add that to the times we've sent notice of intent to sue letters to operations without permits and succeeded in getting them covered by permits, just shy of litigation. It's safe to say that we brought over 200 cases to protect clean water. That is over a 39-year history of the organization. We are really hopeful for the day when these cases won't be necessary. Our vision includes a robust working waterfront that can safely coexist with healthy waterways, with strong pollution safeguards and corporations that are accountable for complying with all pollution safeguards, where our policing isn't necessary. We just aren't there yet. We also have filed lawsuits against governmental agencies on approximately 50 occasions for adopting rules and permits that aren't strong enough. And by not strong enough, we mean that although they are legal in terms of complying with the CWA, we don't feel that they're strong enough to protect Washington's waters. States can and should go beyond the bare minimum standards set by the Clean Water Act. We will continue to push Washington to do so.
Well, Soundkeeper, I understand, has a nearly 100% success record in Clean Water Act cases. You were just referencing some of those. A 1993 settlement with the city of Bremerton directly contributed to the Dyes Inlet shellfish beds reopening for the first time in 40 years. Is that true? And tell me about that.
Yes, that is true. We have quite a few cases that we can really directly attribute a lot of measurable water quality improvements to, and we're very proud of that. And that is correct. In cases that we have filed lawsuits against permit holders to enforce the terms of permits, our success rate is nearly 100%. And a few recent successes: at the end of December 2021, we joined Earth Justice in challenging a permit issued by the Washington Department of Ecology that allows nutrient pollutants from waste treatment plants to continue to be discharged totally unchecked into Puget Sound and the Washington state waters of the Salish Sea. Excess human-caused nutrient pollution has resulted in and continues to exacerbate damage to the sound. This sewage pollution, and when we're talking about sewage, we're mostly talking about nitrogen, and people often refer to nitrogen also as a nutrient. It feeds algal blooms that harm marine life. It threatens vital salmon habitat. It depletes oxygen levels in the water, and it sets Puget Sound back in our blue carbon goals for mitigating climate change. More recently, we joined Friends of Earth, Earth Justice, and Washington Environmental Council in celebrating a major win for clean water, which is upholding the Puget Sound as a no discharge zone. And this essentially means that boat sewage cannot be dumped directly into the Puget Sound. We're very proud of that ruling. We also, in March, along with Communities for a Healthy Bay, signed a consent decree with Electron Hydro LLC and its chief operating officer, Tom Fisher. He's facing multiple criminal and civil charges over alleged Clean Water Act and Endangered Species Act violations at the Electron Hydro facility on the Puyallup River near Ording, Washington. So this agreement will resolve alleged violations of the Clean Water Act associated with routine dam operations, specifically alleged unpermitted discharges of pollutants, including heat, dead and dying fish, sediments, oils, greases, lubricants, and any other pollutants. I'm not sure if you have seen the pictures or read about this in the papers, but essentially they used old AstroTurf to fill their dams, and then the dam broke and it washed thousands upon probably millions of pieces of tiny little pieces of rubber down the Puyallup River. And there's also a host of other allegations on that case that are working their way through the state and federal courts. And Soundkeeper is going to continue to stand beside the Puyallup tribe, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the state of Washington in this specific fight to protect the Puyallup River.
And thank you for that detail. That's quite a list of projects and challenges. So if you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. And I am Marianne Wagner, today's host for Coastal Cafe. And we're speaking with Blair Engelbrecht and Gillian Filippo with the Puget Sound Keeper Alliance. And We just had a couple more questions, and let's keep on finding out more about what they're up to. I do understand that Puget Sound Keeper encourages local businesses to do their own cleanup by providing them with funds for restoration, education, and water quality mitigation projects. So who are some of your recipients?
Yeah, oftentimes there is a misconception that we run into that Sound Keeper gets to keep all the settlement funds we win for our lawsuits. But in reality, we do not. Per the Clean Water Act, settlement funds go directly to local third-party recipients to spend on environmental benefit projects in the affected watershed. Sound Keeper has directed almost $10 million in legal settlement payments to community clean water efforts. And most recently, we partnered with the Rose Foundation, a granting organization that supports dozens of restoration, education, and monitoring efforts around Puget Sound. They highlight the interconnectedness of clean water protection, remind us that our efforts to protect Puget Sound extend across the entire watershed in all of its complexity. One recipient, Great Peninsula Conservancy on the Kitsap Peninsula, completed the second part of a major restoration project in January. 250 volunteers planted 5,000 trees and upland vegetation on the Klingel Brian Beard Wildlife Refuge in order to complete restoration for salmon habitat. Other Rose Foundation grant recipients can also be found on their website.
Do you create incentives for these local businesses and groups that you're working with on compliance?
So a business who isn't in compliance with a pollution discharge permit is taking a bit of a gamble with their business. They can choose to comply with their permits and install stormwater treatment, or they can choose to save money by not complying and refusing to install a treatment system in the hopes that they won't get caught. And sometimes they win, but they lose if we catch them. And then they have to pay their lawyers, our lawyers, penalties, and then still the costs of installing the treatment systems that they should have just installed in the first place. So we disincentivize that business gamble, and we hope that our cases apply a collective pressure on all permittees, including those that we never sue, in favor of choosing compliance as a really sound business decision. And it's important to note that our end goal is always compliance. So before we even file suit, we give a business an opportunity to comply without litigation by sending a 60-day notice letter. And if they resolve those issues before 60 days passes, then we have reached our goal and the lawsuit is never filed. But a question that I'm much more interested in is, what are the costs of pollution? So I'm not so much interested in, you know, we hear all the time, these treatment systems are really expensive, but we never really talk about what the human costs of pollution are. So sure, it costs money to install a treatment system, but what about the human health costs of noncompliance? So Washington has an outdated water quality standard based on the assumption that Washingtonians, on average, eat 1 8-ounce fillet of fish per month, or 6.5 grams. And that assumption completely ignores that Washington is home to an Asian immigrant and Native American population who eat 250 grams per day for religious, cultural, and subsistence purposes. So how much will a subsistence fishing family's cancer treatment cost when they all get sick from the mercury, arsenic, and PCBs in our water? You know, we're also concerned about tribal members suffering due to decimated salmon populations. Salish Sea Chinook salmon populations are down 60% since the Pacific Salmon Commission began tracking salmon abundance in 1984. So to me, protecting human health and protecting marine resources should be enough of an incentive for a business to comply. But as we've seen, that isn't always the case. And that's why we're here. So I would challenge anyone listening or any businesses who are wondering about what incentive there is that we're providing for them to comply, about why it's our responsibility to provide those incentives. You know, I don't receive an incentive from the government for me not to speed in my car. The incentive is not to get a speeding ticket when I'm driving to work.
Very good example. A good analogy, I would say. And really protecting our marine resources in Washington State go hand in hand with protecting human health. That's your point, I think, is that it's all integrated. It's all one.
And yes.
We are a huge seafood eating state. The communities in Washington State rely heavily on our marine resources. So thank you for clarifying that. I wanted to ask, you host cleanup and education events around the Sound too. What events have you brought to the community and what events are coming up?
Soundkeeper has a variety of community engagement events, such as cleanups and community science programs. Our cleanups consist of beach cleanups and kayak patrols, where we remove marine debris from our waterways. We typically have a beach cleanup about once a month at locations around the region. And our kayak patrols are once a week on Wednesdays, where we pick up trash in Lake Union with kayaks graciously donated by the Northwest Outdoor Center. Additionally, we provide cleanup kits to the community for folks to organize their own cleanup. Our community science projects consist of salmon surveys, where we track the number of returning coho salmon spawning in Longfellow Creek, microplastic analysis, where we document the extent of microplastic pollution in our waterways, and mussel monitoring, where we monitor mussels for toxins in the water. This year, for our microplastic analysis, we'll be shifting to a new protocol that will sample for microplastics in sediment. In terms of some events coming up, we have a Earth Day cleanup at Golden Gardens. This one will be extra special because we'll be using the ETAP protocol, also known as the Escape Trash Assessment Protocol, in collaboration with Zero Waste Washington. For ETAP, volunteers will collect trash from a set boundary and record the types of trash found. The results will contribute to a marine debris monitoring network and support research and science-based policies. We will also be posting more info about our Seattle Summer Cleanup Series on our events page soon. Seattle Summer Cleanup Series is a series of events focused on removing thousands of pounds of debris from Seattle's urban waters. Each cleanup will have a walking cleanup and a water-based kayak and canoeing component.
Thank you, Blair and Gillian. There's lots to look forward to. To learn more about Puget Sound Keeper program, go to pugetsoundkeeper.org. And this has been Marianne Wagner, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the UW College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that support the conservation of our ocean and coastlines. I'd like to thank our station manager, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And as always, a special shout out to the band Kooeeks for sharing their music with us at the open and closing of the program. And thank you for listening. Have a good day.